This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
If your child is neurodiverse, how hard is it to get their hair cut? And when was the last time you were actually able to go to a hairdresser, have them sit in a hairdresser's chair and make it through the entire haircut? It's a sensory overload, from heat to loud sounds, touching. Well, one mum has created kind of a super cape. She's called it a big hug suit, and it's to help not just her son, but others who also struggle with appointments like this. So would a big hug suit maybe help your child? Maybe would it help you get a haircut if you have autism? Louise Milligan will be joining us at around 11:45 today. And this hour, we'll also be looking at that photograph, the photo of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. You know, the one he's sitting in the back of the car exiting the police station. It's gone viral all around the world. So how does a photojournalist manage to get a shot like that? And is the profession dying out? That's all coming up.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So if your child or yourself is neurodiverse, how difficult is it getting a haircut? Because there is so much going on. You've got hair dryers going. You've got multiple people. Sometimes the rooms are really echoey. And then you've got, quite often, a stranger who is touching you as well. So it is an absolute sensory overload. So how do you manage to get through? And how can hairdressers, dentists, doctors, you name it, how can we make sure that everybody feels comfortable getting through those appointments? Well, one mum, Lucy Horn, has gone about creating, I called it a super cape, because that's sort of what it feels like, Lucy. I think you've called it a big hug. But first things first, can you talk us through how stressful going to the hairdresser was for you and for your son?
Absolutely. So it was something you would try and avoid, because it was not only an emotional toll on you seeing your son so physically distressed and emotionally distressed, that something that you take for granted or look forward to in most cases is something really to be avoided.
So what would happen? Would he get into the chair? Would you have fights trying to get him in the car to get to the hairdressers?
Quite often it would be either on my lap, or there'd be a lot of wiggling around and absconding, like out the street. You would be, it wasn't pleasant at all.
Gosh, that must have been stressful for you and for the hairdresser as well.
Absolutely. And knowing that your baby, your child, if they were to go somewhere, you want them to show up to the world that they are loved and cared for and presented and, you know, clean. And because those first impressions last. When you see a child or a person who's looking a little bit disheveled, I wanted people to know this child is extremely loved.
And you don't want to cut his hair. Cutting hair's hard. It's a skill, right?
I didn't want to embarrass him.
I know, we all learned that during COVID, that actually hairdressing is a skill, and to not take it for granted. For many of us, Lucy, we have long relationships with our hairdressers, sometimes for decades, and they're very personal relationships, and we often divulge things to our hairdresser that we may not divulge to anyone else. So were you able to build a relationship with a hairdresser to say, look, you know, my son has special needs, hairdressing, going to the hairdressers just freaks him out, how can we work together?
We were, and that is that intense sound of a razor around your ear and the strong smells and often the really harsh lighting that has to be in a salon. So with Big Hug, I also found that the anxiety was creeping up around mealtimes as well. So that's how it started. But that relationship with my son, he actually had some other complex needs. So we were in Melbourne a lot. So we had to use different hairdressers at times.
Mm. So what did you create? What did you go and make? You've called it the big hug suit. But what is it? Talk us about what you've created.
So it's using deep muscle pressure, so to lower the cortisol in the body, to release that tension, promote calm and time for connection. So it wraps around your shoulders, your chest and your upper back. So it's giving that feeling of a big embrace right when you need it the most. So it's weighted and it's got a, it looks like a hairdressing cape from the outside. No one would know the difference, but it's actually weighted internally.
And how does it make a difference? Is there things to sort of fidget with and play with? The weight, I guess, this makes you feel calmer anyhow, doesn't it?
Yeah. So when Jake was about four, I started experimenting with weighted blankets, and they were, it's like, how could I use this? But they're all the wrong shape. They were getting filthy and dirty. They just weren't fit for purpose at all. So that's how I started to change and make my own. Like, how can this work? And it's grown and grown to now, as you pointed out, it's got some regulation tools we've built in, and they are interchangeable with which fits. So you can be quite discreet. So in our trials where we've just used with adults as well and neurotypical, they have much preferred it, and they can put their hands inside the cape and be fiddling. Those regulation tools can be moved to the outside. So they're like fidgets, but some of them are textural, they move, and it stops little hands going up and being quite dangerous. So it's
absolutely
sort of
safety
as well.
Thing, right? You've got really sharp scissors. Mm. Just finally, Lucy, I know people later today, the ABC story will be up on our website. One of our colleagues, ABC journalist Andrew Mangelsdorf, has done an online piece that's photographs of this cape, this big hug suit that you've created, will be up online a little later today. Can it be used in other settings? Could you use it on an aeroplane, for example?
Oh, definitely. So I'm a speech pathologist and have my own clinic. So we've been using it in clinic to help with tasks. And then that's probably where the idea came to share with other parents. Oh, this could be used in other high anxiety situations like dentists, the pathology. And I've had some interest from an aged care facility. So because it's that mealtime reminder as a visual, to it's time to sit and eat and things like that. So I think it could be, yeah, really versatile.
Well done. I'm glad things have got a little easier for you, Lucy. Lucy Horn, as we said, her story will be up on the ABC's website a little later today, where you can have a look at those images. Lots of people saying, oh, wow, even just brushing hair at home, this could be really helpful. This message from Justine, and it says, for my child, they have long hair due to this exact thing. He has a haircut only once or twice a year. It gets out of control. We get it cut at when it's just too hard to brush. Even brushing knotty hair is a disaster too. Lucy Horn, thank you. We wish you all the best. This haircutting cape sounds like it works on the Temple Grandin principles. Temple invented the hugging machine for calming livestock in the US after using it on herself as a woman on the spectrum. That's from Denise. And another that says, I don't go to the hairdressers for the same reasons, but also because of the social interaction. All of the questions that the hairdresser asks, it's just too stressful. I'm lucky now that I'm pretty much bald and I can just cut it myself. However, Sarah says, I have neurodivergent kids and they actually love getting a haircut. Not all autistic people have those same challenges. Please make sure you present this. Well, one man, Mr. D, who's from Delilah Hair Studio, really thinks outside the square in many areas when it comes to getting a haircut and the role that hairdressers play in our lives, and to not oversimplify the role, Mr. D, that hairdressers play in our lives. If someone comes to you and says either I or my child is neurodiverse, getting my haircut is really stressful. How do you approach that?
Great question, and what an important topic. Salons, as you've just said before, they are such sensory overload places to visit sometimes. Hair dryers, the echo, it's so true. We actually have a couple of express services because we don't really have the ability to minimise any of those other sensory things in a salon because we're quite a small space. So we have two express services. One's called a quick chop, which is a half an hour haircut where it's no wash and style. So you can have your full haircut, but have minimal contact with the person and get out a bit quicker. And we also have one that's even quicker than that called a fringe face and crown, which is 15 minutes. Perfect for those who don't like visiting the salon, but want to get their fringe out of their face and just really freshen up their haircut in a very short space of time.
That sounds good to me. Anyhow, we don't all have heaps of time. What I love about the work that you've done over the years in the three R's and just training people, Mr. D, on how much we divulge, how much information, how much trust we put into hairdressers. And when you think about the physical touching, having your hair washed, for example, not everybody's going to like that or want that.
Not everyone loves it. Not everyone loves it at all, no. So I love that we now live in a world where you can have those conversations and minimise that contact if that's what you're after.
So should people contact the salon beforehand and have a chat and say, look, I just wanted to talk to you about, you know, maybe how I'm feeling or some of the issues that my child may have with getting a haircut? Is that a good first step? Or are there ways of figuring out who is going to be a salon that suits you?
That's such a great question. People either call and have a chat to our front of house or their stylist and talk about things they're experiencing, or when they book online, they'll send a note saying, you know, here's some things that I'd like you to be aware of, which we love. So we can actually create a space where everybody's comfortable. And I think previously, especially the 90s and early 2000s, people would have to mask in a salon and then leave quite exhausted. So now we can sort of take the pressure off that and they don't have to leave quite so tired.
Yeah. I mean, I even just saw a sign the other day on the weekend at a shopping centre, and it was like a gaming shop, and it had a big sign out the front letting people know when they had their low sensory hours and what time they could come. So even as a salon, if you think, oh, wow, I've never thought about this, maybe having a little sign saying, hey, please contact us if, you know, you would like sensory hours or a sensory type haircut, and maybe that salon can accommodate for you or at least discuss it with you.
What a great idea. I think all of these little things make up to a huge step forward.
Lovely to speak with you as always. Thank you, Mr. D.
Thank you.
Mr. D from Delilah Hair Studio. Well, maybe you're a hairdresser and you've thought about this as well. Maybe you've popped a little sign up that says, speak to us, you know, if you would like to come at a time when it's quieter, if you would like us to not talk to you, or if you would like to not have your hair washed or have it done in a faster fashion. And as I said, you can jump on to see that big hug suit on ABC's website. It'll be up a little later today, and that's been done by Andrew Mangalsdorf, who is one of the ABC journos in New South Wales. Coming up in about half an hour's time, Louise Milligan will be joining you. You would have been hearing about her Four Corners report today, so she's going to be joining you at a quarter to 12. But up next, we're going to look at the science and the precise skill that goes behind getting one of those iconic photographs that we saw happen that went all around the world of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. That's up next.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So whether it be Princess Di, Erin Patterson, those images, those photos in the newspaper that you remember, and just how important a really strong image is in print today, given how we get our news is so different. But when we think about the one photograph of late, there's a pretty good chance you've seen it. It's already iconic. It's the image of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Pale, eyes wide open, in a state of shock, sitting in the back of his car as he left the police station. So how do you get a photo like that? It was taken by Reuters journalist Phil Noble. This is him describing detail by detail of how he actually took that photo.
There's so many moving parts. You don't know where the car is going to come from, where he's going to be sitting in the car. Obviously, it's dark, so you need to use flash. It's hit and miss. Probably half an hour before I took the photo, I'd done some test shots of other cars leaving the police station. So I had a rough idea of what the camera settings may be. But it's still, you know, more than luck than judgment. When the car comes out, you've got to try and guess where he's sitting, which side of the car is he? Is he in the front? Is he in the back? Will the flash recycle in time? Yeah, the photo gods were on my side yesterday.
Well, was it the photo gods or was it just years of skill? I found that absolutely fascinating. So that was Reuters journalist Phil Noble, who took that photograph of Andrew that has gone global around the world. Andrew Mears is a former Fairfax photographer and a former press gallery president. Andrew, I mean, he said, you know, the luck pretty much was on his side. But when you listen to the detail, to the rehearsal behind it, it doesn't really feel like luck. It feels like a hell of a lot of skill went into that. What did you first think when you saw the photograph that Phil took?
I agree with your take. I think Phil's being incredibly humble here about lucky, because as a photographer, we used to have this expression, you're only as good as the last photo you took. And you knew that, as he said, for everything to align, that was a success metric. But he knows it could have just meant the smallest little variable meant he didn't get that picture that day. So you approach your craft with a great humility. However, you're absolutely right. I think Phil's building upon decades of experience. He's a really talented sports photographer. So he's used to an ephemeral moment, and you need to anticipate that. So if you're photographing the Melbourne tennis and you see the tennis ball, it's too late. You have to anticipate where that tennis ball will be, where the athlete will be in fractions of a second before it happens. So you build up, I guess, a pattern recognition. And Phil gave away one of his little secrets there, is he let off some test shots in a car before. So he removed the variables of his technical affordances. So it meant his camera had the right settings. He knew the flash could punch through the windscreen. And then focusing is a massive challenge. Cameras are brilliant these days in the autofocus, but that doesn't always work when you're going through a moving car and glass at night. So my guess is Phil probably had a focal zone, like he preset his camera, and as the car came through, he clicked the shutter, and it's perfect, right? Like, it's in focus, framed beautifully with the police detail in the front seats. So he's got the composition, the focus, and the lighting that we got to see inside that car.
Unbelievable. It's interesting, right? There's a question here, Andrew, that's come in on text from Mark, and it says, Rish, surely the question is, why do we need a photo like this? I certainly don't. Now, that's totally fine for Mark to have the opinion that he doesn't need that photograph. And I guess the bigger question for me to you is it important to have a photograph like that? Why is it important to have a photograph like that?
Look, I think as humans and as society and as a culture, we relate through story. And my wife said to me the other night, Andrew Mountbatten's been arrested. And, like, just hearing that, like, we know there's a backstory here, but it was such a disruption of an equilibrium. And that drives our narratives. Like, how will this story end? Mm. And so processing such an enormity of that, it's going to take us a while. We're still talking what does this mean globally? What does it mean for Australia? What does it mean for all our institutions? And so having a visual narrative to support that builds our understanding, and we get to have a talk about it. And I think the reason that photograph is so powerful, I think, one, there's scarcity. It's just Phil's image. And it's a moment we don't normally get to see. The Royals are possibly the most carefully curated celebrities in the history of, you know, image making, right? Since that moment, you know, Prince and Princess of Wales are at the BAFTA Awards wearing black tie and amazing dresses. You know, King Charles attended charity things and a fashion week. We're at the rugby. You know, these are curated, carefully appearances. And here you have one of their family members lying down in a car, trying not to be seen. And that moment of authority and performative authenticity, stripped, where the performer in these roles is stripped, right? Yeah. And so it's really powerful. So we're trying to reconcile that image with the curated image built over, well, his 66 years, his whole life he's been in the public.
Yeah, it was his birthday. And Andrew Mears, as a former Fairfax photographer and the former press gallery president, and we know that you're also a professor at the moment at ANU. When we look at how we document history now and the role that photographs play in documenting history and where it sits, you know, does a photograph tell us everything? Does it need the words around it? Like, how important are images in capturing a moment in time and being stored correctly, being held on to correctly?
Yeah, a lot of my work now involves looking at an incredible photo archive of technicals. I'm really interested in telegraphy and how photography and telegraphy in Australia grew up at the same time in the 1850s. And so my work is hugely rich because I'm able to reinterpret these photographs from that period. So I obviously have a huge interest in these images of who we are at that time and the context in which that image was made being preserved. And so I think it's amazing the amount of imagery we have now. And if we take another profound event that happened in Sydney in December last year at Bondi, the horror of that, even I was astounded at the number of videos, camera phones, CCTV footage. There was even a drone above that incident. So we're living in a really highly imaged, sensed world that leads to incredible global distribution networks to share these images. And I think photojournalism is important because here you have a skilled curator in Phil Noble and distribution networks that can clearly say the authorship of this image, it was not a construct, it was not a computer generation, it was not AI generated. It has an author and a specificity to it in a context of which it was made that helps us make sense of the world. And so that output becomes a new input that we get to understand our world. So I'm a huge proponent of the media industry. It doesn't always get it right, but it allows us to have conversations and be in a dialogue. And I think a visual component of that's hugely important.
The world of photojournalism, I wonder what its future is. I have someone very close to me who's a photojournalist. And when you look through a lens and how intense that is, how personal that feels, how close everything feels. And then on top of that, if you're photographing something stressful, if you're photographing someone in a moment of stress, if you're photographing a community that's been through trauma, through bushfire, I wonder how healthy the world of photojournalism is. Like, are people, and given that everyone's got a camera in their back pocket now, in their handbag, in their backpack, whatever, from 12-year-olds to 80-year-olds, are people still wanting to be photojournalists? Is that skill, is that craft still recognised?
Look, I think so, because there's an intensity to it. So you could argue there's more sort of content creators than ever before. So there's an increase in skill level. The distribution models have changed and the economic models that perpetuate that. So I grew in newspapers in an era when they were supported by kind of monopolies in a way and the control of classified advertising that funded journalism. But in my lifetime, that as my cameras got better and the distribution networks, electronic screens got incredible way to reach an audience, the economic models had collapsed sitting behind that. So the sort of funded photojournalistic model is absolutely under threat, but it emerges in different ways of, I think people use the phrase a side hustle now or other aspects. I still think there's some really strong projects and there's an sort of more moving towards the artistic spectrum. So instead of documentary photography being in news, you're getting these bigger cultural critiques, whether it be country footy or you know, Outback Australia. You get these other beautiful blogs and books that come from it. So I think it's alive and vibrant and a strong voice.
That's
and I think
good.
The diversity of women and other cultures really expressing their gaze, like their opportunity, instead of, you know, in my case, being a non-Indigenous person being sent to photograph an Indigenous community. I have a particular cultural lack of understanding and knowing how to navigate that world. So I'm really, I think we've seen a huge growth in that diversity of cultural awareness being enabled through photography from their perspective.
So and that's right, and how personal it is. Yeah. It's interesting because there's a lot of pushback on whether or not we, coming through on text saying, you know, we don't need these images, and others saying, absolutely we do. One that says, you know, images like this are so important, they end up being iconic in terms of our history, whether it's positive or negative. It's something that jolts our memory to the future. I can think much of the Nikki Winmar photo. That's from Courtney in Seabrook, and I have one of those photos. I actually bought it from The Age officially of Nikki Winmar. And when he was here at work, I reckon the only signature I've ever asked for in my entire life. But you know what was important at the time? He may have felt guilted into it because I was heavily pregnant, but I made sure it was an official photograph, and I said that to him. I said, this is not just printed off something random. You know, this is the actual photograph that I've paid for through the journalist as well, because there is a story behind it, not just of him, but of the person who was there who managed to take it. Andrew Mears, what's the difference between this photo that Phil Noble took and the skill that it takes as a photojournalist and a paparazzi and kind of how globally hated they are for the work that they do?
Oh, look, I mean, the irony is the skill required was kind of the same technically.
Yeah, right. That's interesting, isn't it?
Being in the right place at the right time and being able to render an image that you can then share, right? So I think that's the same. I guess there's the paparazzi is the Italian word for fly. It comes out of La Dolce Vita and, you know, famous actresses in Italy at that time. So there's a level of, like, annoyance and pest, I think, to it, which I guess, you know, I've been at the end of that, but I'm working for, you know, the Fourth Estate and the noble journalism as opposed to a celebrity economy. So I guess there's the political economy sitting behind your question. Certainly when, after the tragedy of Princess Diana's death, I couldn't walk down the street without being called this beautiful Italian word. So it became a slur. But it was the craft is the same. The model supporting it is a bit different. And I think context is probably the nuance. So I would argue that photojournalism is sitting in a much bigger journalistic praxis, which what I mean by that is the values behind that and how that gets checked and shared and the reputation that's at stake, where paparazzi is just trying to sell an image. So it's often perhaps the image is out of context because that helps drive sales. I think that'd be the nuance I'd put between the two.
That's interesting, isn't it? I mean, you can have an opinion, but then are you clicking on the photo? You know, it's a supply and demand issue.
You do remind me of, I photographed Prince Charles as he was then in Sydney once, and I stood up because I had like a front row opportunity for where we were, and I got hit multiple times on the back of the head with an umbrella. And the members of the public were like, we came here to see him, not see the back of your head. And I'm like, okay, I'm very sorry. So I ducked down. But I remember thinking, I'm not here because I want to be here. I'm here because of people like you.
Yeah, who want the image.
the image that I'm taking. And not all of you can be here. And so therefore I'm, you know, sharing this moment for others. It's
That's right. I had William's Minder push my microphone. There's this classic photograph of me, I think, in the Australian, and my microphone being pushed out of the way by his Minder, and they were getting really upset at me. And it's the same kind of principle. People want to hear it. They want the stories. And in order to do that, you've got to be a bit bolshy sometimes. Just finally, Andrew Mears, there's a text here that says, well, so how many of these images now are fake? And you did just touch on AI, but if the future of paparazzi, the future of photojournalists, the future of newspapers, even having any photographers on staff, what we click on, what we don't, how much of that will just be fake into the future?
Yeah, it is sort of the liar's dividend, right? So you sort of open up your social media and you scroll and you just don't know anymore. So I think the veracity metrics I use is, you know, who is the author? Who is sharing this? Is it true to the original? Has it been manipulated in any way? And there's certainly some technical tools the big camera and image companies are putting in that give you kind of like a supply chain. So just with our food production systems, you can go from paddock to plate and know where did this originate from. They're bringing some of that incredible technology too, because it is a little bit of a crisis. But I could also give you a story of way before we had digital photography and AI, that this being fooled and confused has long visual histories. And so we've muddled through all of that just fine. And I think truth will prevail because we've got such a critical appraisal of our world and asking questions and proving these things. Is, you know, it sits behind our legal systems, our political systems, our scientific systems, and journalism is not without scrutiny. So I think that's where I sit, that having a healthy discourse, and I'd put to your listeners and the readers of these platforms have more say than ever before, and they're actively listening and keeping us aligned. So I think that's a healthy ecosystem.
Andrew says this, I reckon that photographer used a manual flash, a wide-angle lens and an aperture probably of 4.6 at a 60th of a second and maybe a filter for glass. None of that makes any sense to me, but is he right, do you think, Andrew?
I think he's right on every count there. Perhaps I wouldn't say it's a wide-angle lens. I think it's quite a long lens. But yes, you're
bang on.
Well, when you get to take as many pictures as Phil Noble and I have, you kind of get used to the mistakes and you learn from them, because when you miss a picture, it's a gut-wrenching feeling and you regret it. And then you don't really bask in your glory. So I just say Phil was like happy he's taken an image, but I think he's the counterfactual. It reminds me of the Olympics at the moment. If you win a bronze medal, you're smiling, even because the counterfactual is you go home with nothing. So Phil came away from that with an incredible image, but he knows that it, you know, one slight change there and he wouldn't have had it.
Yeah, absolutely. Fascinating to pick your brain on this, Andrew. Thank you.
No, thank you for the opportunity. Yeah, keep a critical eye out is my tip and enjoy.
Yeah, really good advice.
Even if it's uncomfortable, question that. Why does that image make me feel uncomfortable?
Andrew Mears, good to speak with you. Thank you. Former Fairfax photographer and former press gallery president, currently a professor at the ANU. We were talking about that photograph of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor taken by Reuters journalist Phil Noble. Coming up in about 10 minutes' time, Louise Milligan will be joining you, of course, for that story on Four Corners that we've been talking about all morning. But up next, have you fallen for some online viral food trend? Is there yogurt and biscuits in your house? Are you falling for some kind of cottage cheese flatbread? And what is it about influencers and food that has become so popular that now we can't even get yogurt half the time at our local supermarket?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So if you've been sucked into some kind of viral food trend, and it's interesting to think about why some food trends become so popular, right? So intensely viral and popular that they cause real-time food outages and shortages at the supermarket. So there's a couple at the moment that are doing the rounds, the Japanese cheesecake. So it's just two ingredients. It involves a little biscuit and yogurt. That's it. So that's probably why you cannot get Greek yogurt at your supermarket at the moment. Then there's cottage cheese flatbread. There is a limit on cottage cheese at my supermarket. You know, it's like toilet paper in COVID days. You're only allowed two containers of cottage cheese. Another I was reading about, haven't tried it, but let's say I'm interested, dumpling lasagna. Winning on both accounts there. However, food influencers are causing actual shortages at the supermarket. Stephen Conway, a senior lecturer and course director for games and interactivity at Swinburne University. Has there been a long history with food influencers to the point now where they're causing havoc at our supermarket and shortages on things like cottage cheese and Greek yogurt, Stephen?
Morning, Rochelle. I think that kind of shortage on a national scale and a global scale is perhaps quite new, but we can go back hundreds of years to different food crazes that meant there were shortages of certain things available. And, you know, it's really down to the fact that we have this biological imperative to copy. It's one of our great advantages as a species, I think, is to be able to imitate and copy success. But sometimes it goes a bit haywire and we find ourselves short of Greek yogurt or toilet paper. And this is one such instance.
Absolutely. I mean, I think TikTok is to blame at the moment for the Japanese cheesecake, although I have to say it does look delicious. I haven't tried it.
It does.
But, yeah, have you tried it?
I have tried something very close and it is quite, I can't believe you said dumpling lasagna. That is a phrase I understand the words in isolation. Yes. I just don't understand together how they work and I'm not going to try.
Dumplings, good. Lasagna, yes. Good. You
it's
put
the
them
Joey
together?
Solution, right? Yeah. It's Joey. Bad. But he'll eat it.
How can it not be good? Dumpling lasagna. If anyone has tried it, cooked it, or knows how to make dumpling lasagna, you can give us a call, 1-300-222-774. What's fascinating about the cottage cheese trend, and that's been around for a while, there's been shortages, there were people who have made it who had no idea it was having a resurgence. It was big in the 80s. Do trends like this, I mean, sourdough was one, right, where it came and then sort of went, it sort of stays around. Do they hang around for a long time? Do they have longevity?
Right. The half-life of trends is becoming shorter and shorter due to technological advances. So, you know, the famous, I believe, Oscar Wilde quote is, fashion is something so ugly it has to change its face every 6 months. And I think that used to be the case 100 years ago, where you would have these trends. We go back all the way back to Alexander the Great shaving his beard, and that became a massive fashion trend. Maybe that's when Greek yogurt first faced its shortage for the clean shaven, you know, rash that you would get. You would soothe it maybe with Greek yogurt. But we've had these trends for thousands of years, but now, because of technology, the idea of what we call conspicuous consumption is becoming more rapid. So it's not enough to be a consumer in modern society under capitalism, because what you own is who you are. In capitalism, how much value you own is how much value you have as a person. At least that's what capitalism says. So it's not enough to consume things. You have to be conspicuous about it. You have to be seen doing it. So you can't just own a bag or a pair of shoes or a jacket. You have to own the right brand of shoes, jacket, and so on. And so, yes, this is a kind of rapid global version of that, where every week we're going, well, what can we now do to set ourselves apart and say we are cooler than whoever else was doing something last week? And I think the accessibility of yogurt and the accessibility of, God forbid, dumplings and lasagna means that more people can imitate, right? It's the cost barrier is very low when it's yogurt. It's much higher when it's a Ferrari or a Louis Vuitton bag. So, you know, the ability for more people to partake and imitate in the trend, I think the more life it has.
Well, there are lots of people that are saying, yep, I've tried the dumpling lasagnas 20 minutes in the pan. Let's just say it didn't look like the videos, but tasted okay. I still need more details on this. Stephen, good to speak with you.
I do not need more details.
I think I am there for it. Stephen Conway, Senior Lecturer and Course Director for Games and Interactivity at Swinburne University. Louise Milligan coming up in a couple of minutes' time. But the BAFTAs have just come to a close, and Velvet Winter is an ABC arts journalist and has been following the BAFTA Awards. They've just wrapped up around an hour or two ago, Velvet. These are kind of the last major precursor to the Oscars. We all know that certain events give us a little sneaky window into who may or may not be happy on Oscar night. What happened? Well, who got Film of the Year?
Okay, so Film of the Year, up until this point, it's been a big battle, ironically, between One Battle After Another and Sinners for kind of best film. One Battle After Another did win the BAFTA today, along with Paul Thomas Anderson, its director, winning Best Director. So I think you're kind of, it could still be an upset because Sinners got so many nominations at the Oscars, but at the moment it's kind of looking like One Battle After Another's battle to lose, ironically.
So what were the big upsets?
The biggest upset from today was definitely in Leading Actor. Leading Actor is kind of like, the BAFTAs are one of the bigger precursors to the Oscars, so you kind of can get a sense of who's going to win the Oscar from the BAFTA. But this year, Robert Aramayo, from a movie called I Swear, a British actor, won Leading Actor, and he is not nominated for an Oscar. So he beat people like Timothy Chalamet, Leonardo DiCaprio, Ethan Hawke. He beat them all. So it's kind of a guessing game up at this point. Timothy Chalamet has had an incredibly strong season. It's kind of his award to lose at the Oscars, but we've got nothing from the BAFTAs today because they chose a rogue winner.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And does that happen very often?
Not really at the BAFTAs. I think it was the first time in first time since Billy Elliot, I believe, that Jamie Bell won for Billy Elliot, that an actor who is not nominated for an Oscar has won leading actor.
Yeah, that was some time ago.
Yeah, definitely some time ago.
And what about the Australians? Because we've got a plethora of Aussies doing really well at these awards at the moment.
We've got two big hopefuls for this year. They are Rose Byrne in leading actress for If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You. If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, and then Jacob Elordi for Frankenstein. Unfortunately, both of them missed out today. I was really hoping Rose Byrne would get in for leading actress. She won a lot of like smaller precursor awards at the beginning of the season, but she's had some fierce competition from Jesse Buckley from Hamnet, and it's a British awards show, so went to a British actress, so you don't, that's kind of not unexpected, but at this point it would be a surprise if Rose Byrne could beat Jessie Buckley for the leading actress Oscar, which is a shame. Supporting actor, which is the one that Jacob Elordi is in, is a bit more of a toss-up. Elordi got the Critics' Choice Award earlier in the year, and then the Globe went to Stellan Skarsgård, and now the BAFTA has gone to Sean Penn. Mm. So it's really, they're sharing that one around. It's not really, it would be a surprise if Elordi broke through, just considering how respected Penn and Skarsgård are, but, you know, stranger things have happened.
So, Velvet, any truth in the fact that, this is a question without notice, that Elordi is going to be the next James Bond?
I have heard reports of that. Yeah. I'm not Barbara Broccoli. I can't confirm nor deny, okay. But he's definitely tall enough to be.
Well, you know? I heard he's too tall, right? That all of he's 6'5 or something, and apparently he's too tall to be Bond. I reckon he'd make a great Bond, just quietly.
I think so. He would have to polish up the British accent a bit. I don't know if you've seen Wuthering Heights yet, but a little bit of the Australian twang still snuck through.
There's still time. Good on you, Velvet. Thank you, Velvet Winter, ABC arts journalist who's been following the BAFTAs.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So endometriosis, basically it's something we've only just started to talk about, to take seriously. We know that a diagnosis can take years and quite often symptoms aren't even believed. So when someone like the health minister says that he was disgusted when it was reported that women who were told that they had endometriosis, who went on to had life-changing surgery, some of them 7 times, you know, things like ovaries removed, even a uterus removed when they didn't need to. And you've been hearing these stories all morning, and this story was uncovered by Louise Milligan, of course, of Four Corners, and she joins us now. Louise, it is. Disgusting is the right word. Unthinkable, life-changing, sickening, you name it. How did this story come to you? How did you discover this? How did all of these women come to you?
Well, we found them, but we did a story last year called God Complex for Four Corners about a neurosurgeon. And after that story, his credentialing to practice in the hospital was removed and he had conditions placed on his registration. We had a huge response to that from health professionals and patients around the country talking about other practitioners. And one response stood out, and that was allegations that there was a surgeon in Melbourne, a gynecologist, who was removing tissue and reproductive organs from young women for endometriosis in circumstances where the pathology showed that there wasn't endometriosis. And I mean, when I first found out about this, I was like, gosh, I just can't imagine that we'll be able to stack this up. But secondly, you know, even if I can, how am I going to sort of find these people?
Especially given that, as I said, you know, we're still learning about endometriosis. We're still starting to only believe women's pain in general. Mm. So if you're in that vulnerable state where someone has said to you, yeah, okay, Louise, you've got endometriosis, you know, the only way you're going to get through this is if I remove your ovaries, and you've got no other information, you've got nothing else to back it on, you trust, right? The amount of trust that you put into these professionals, you would expect that that's the reason why some women in particular have gone through up to 7 different types of surgery.
And part of the reason why I felt so much empathy for these women is I have had a hysterectomy at Epworth Private Hospital in circumstances where I had already had 2 children and where it was indicated for the right, it was for adenomyosis, not endometriosis. But I remember that vulnerability.
Yeah.
I remember being in so much pain that I could barely stand up. And I remember desperately wanting a solution for that. And so, yes, you put so much trust in your surgeon, and I had a wonderful surgeon and I had wonderful care at Epworth. So I could really understand what these women were going through. And, you know, in the worst example that we know of, there's a young woman, Courtney Patton, who had 7 laparoscopies with Simon Gordon by the time she was 25. He took out both of her ovaries and her uterus. She is infertile, and on all of the pathology taken the day of her operations, there is no endometriosis. There's one tiny sample that says, that the pathologist says words the effect of could be consistent with endometriosis, but he was operating for severe endometriosis. And gynecologists have told us that this surgery was unnecessary and it's sickening.
This is a little bit of one of the women that you spoke to who people will be able to see on Four Corners tonight.
There were 5 separate pieces of tissue that had been sent off to pathology, and all of them came back saying no endometriosis present. And his handwriting was right next to it saying nil. I just broke out in a sweat, broke out in tears, and I just was in shock.
So, Louise Milligan, how has the surgeon responded? You, no doubt, would have offered a right of reply, would have said, join us, sit down, let's talk. How has that been handled?
Well, first of all, the surgeon, Simon Gordon, we asked him on many occasions to do an interview, and he said no, ultimately. He gave us a statement and he said that words to the effect of that, you know, he never did surgery unless it was to alleviate women's pain. And he's, you know, he made the point that women have been unheard, women with endometriosis for many years, and, you know, he was seeking to hear them. And, you know, you have to sort of ask the question, at what point does recognising women's suffering tip over into something really concerning? Mm. As to the hospital...
Because there would be women who have got surgeries lined up who would be listening to this worried.
Yes, and
and not just at that hospital, at any hospital. This is the thing about checks and balances.
And the gynecologists we spoke to on camera were worried about that. They're worried about the fact that, you know, women might not have care that they need because they're concerned about this.
What have the Epworth said that they'll do?
Yeah, so when we started investigating this, we had a call in October from a crisis communications professional from Epworth, or working for Epworth, and basically within a couple of days, the chief medical officer of Epworth asked Simon Gordon to go on leave. Mm-hmm. And a few days later, he retired, quote unquote, to spend time with his family, cancelled all his surgeries for the following week. Epworth had multiple complaints to management about this, to multiple different managers about this over a number of years. And for some reason, nothing happened.
How hard is it to get people to speak out? I know tonight you do have other professionals and other surgeons who have spoken out. Is there sort of an unwritten code, a fear, a hierarchy that stops people from speaking out?
Absolutely. So we spoke to a couple of gynecologists who talked about this, that, you know, one of them, Dr. Shami Kathrasinghe, she talked about that issue. I think you've got a grab.
Yeah, this is her.
I think most of us are scared.
Why is that?
Many of us who've ever, throughout our career, if we've ever tried to speak up, we've often been punished for speaking up. For myself, I am a female surgeon working in Melbourne. If I add the part that I'm a brown female surgeon, then that makes it much more difficult for me to speak up. And I hope that this will be a changing point for us in medicine, where we do not blame the people that speak up, but we look at how, as a system, we can do better, because our patients deserve better.
Is that what you're hoping out of this, is that the system needs to be better, our patients deserve better? Because as I just said before, there would be a lot of people now worried about getting accurate information.
Having spent 7 months with these women, I hope that so fervently. There are multiple things going on at the moment Medicare's doing an inquiry into his billing because he was charging for a surgery which was for severe endometriosis in circumstances where there was none. ARPRA is now doing a large investigation after years of complaints from women in which they were knocked back by ARPRA.
Is the health minister doing enough?
The health minister, the federal health minister, has referred it to the Victorian health minister. He's asked for an inquiry by Safer Care Victoria. Marianne Thomas, the state health minister, said today she can't quite say what's happening yet. I think that there might be an announcement about this later in the week. That would be my tip.
7 months in the making, it's a long time. I mean, that's the thing, right? You need the trust, you need the accuracy as well. It is online. It will be on Four Corners tonight and, of course, on iView. There would be a lot of women today, Louise Milligan, saying thank you. Thank you for raising this. And it just shows how much more we've got to learn about women's pain and trusting yourself and asking those questions.
Yeah, no, I feel really privileged to be able to do this work, and I hope it leads to some change.
Louise Milligan, who is a part of the Four Corners team, and you'll be able to see that report this evening. Thank you.
Thanks.
That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.